This is Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange.
I live right in the middle of the woods. This big thing was 75 feet away from me, smelled awful, devoured a whole deer carcass, and then took off and, like, screeched, and took off across the street. And I know you guys are going to think I'm crazy, but I'm dead serious. There was something very big, bigger, a lot bigger than me, out here. How long ago did this happen? Immediately. I don't know if animal control, I mean, it is a very large, hairy animal of some kind.
Now, was it standing on two or four?
Well, if I told you it was standing on two legs, you're going to think I'm crazy, but I'm serious. It ran off at breaking limbs and trees. And it kind of screeched how a very creepy, scary thing. Because, like I said, I live in a tent. We're in the woods. And I just saw this freaky, scary, very large creature devour a deer and run off across the road.
Okay,
I don't know.
Is there any way that we can have an officer contact you?
Yeah, I guess it's this number.
Okay, and do you see signs of a dead deer, blood, whatever?
I'm not going to go check it out right at the moment. Is that okay? Like I said, I thought somebody should know there's a very large something big enough to eat a deer and as a predator.
Are you seeing someone there?
Yes, ma'am.
Did they see you too?
Yes, ma'am.
I lived in the woods 6 years. I swear to God, I've never seen nothing like this. This was bigger than me.
And it,
I'm 6 feet. It's bigger than me.
It's very large. He carried the carcass off. I mean,
oh, he carried
like,
it
with
okay.
Nothing like this.
But I'm the one that picked up that deer and walked with 2 feet.
It's a very large something that smells bad and is bigger than we are. My husband's a very large, nothing's ever scared him, and, I mean, we both saw it, so.
Okay, all right, we'll have an officer patrol that area.
Strange Harbor, be strange.
Another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. We talk about UFOs and ghosts, alien abductions, Sasquatch, conspiracy theories, and so much more. And I am Johnny Manson. She is MUFON investigator Sherita Seuss. She's keeping it real with UFOs, and she's out today. So you got little old me. Our guest today, cryptozoologist extraordinaire Mr. Adam Davis. Welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you, Johnny. Thanks for having me.
What have you been doing? We've seen you on TV. We've seen you on documentaries. I think the last time we spoke, you were going to go stay up in Alaska at some deserted town or something along those lines. Did that ever happen?
Really, like something out of a Stephen King novel, which I'll come on to in a minute. But basically, in synopsis, in the 1950s, there was a thriving little town called Port Chatham. In the Canary Peninsula. I mean, it wasn't a couple of shops, it had a post office. And then something that they called the Hairy Man started to kill people. It got so bad they put armed security around the town. They still started to kill people. As a result, the town was completely abandoned. And I was doing an expedition in Vancouver Island when I met Stephen Major, and he was telling me about this story. And he said, you know, I'd really love to go out there. And, you know, will you come with me, bearing in mind all your background doing survival and expeditions in remote parts of the world, you know, you've been to the Congo, places like that. I said, yeah, I'd love to go. So we went, you know, and I was fascinated by the story because it's one of those few examples of when civilization has actually been pushed back. And, you know, it was a very incredible adventure. And to organize it, at first nobody would take us, because you have to travel by boat. And, you know, even the native local people were saying, well, you know, it's an evil place, man, you shouldn't go. And we did, obviously, and I survived, and I shot some very interesting footage, which I'll tell you about in a minute, if you like. But in synopsis, fascinating, a fascinating place. I mean, the locals were just happy to see us alive when we come back. They were, like, shaking their hands, saying, wow, you survived. And then, as a result of that, I went back a second time, and I made a Travel Channel film, which you can see some very interesting stuff on. I'll tell you about in a minute. And very recently, in the last few weeks, I've just launched a novel called Revenge of the Hairy Man, which is about, it imagines what happened in the 1950s to cause all this. So, just think that it's a great story, and it's true. What more, it's true, you know. So I thought it was like a Stephen King novel, and I thought, well, I'll write a novel about it. I had a policeman out there, a really good friend of mine, Larry Beans Baxter. He checked out the story. He spoke to a lady who was a child there in the 1950s. And, you know, it's a true story. Incredible.
You talked about a book.
Yeah, because I was so fascinated by the story, because, you know, to do investigations, it has to be something unusual that really sparks my interest. You know, it has to be something different. And that was really cutting edge. I thought, going to the idea, this town that's been abandoned, which struck fear into the inhabitants of the locals, and the fact that it really was abandoned, and it really was a town, just not a few shacks, led me to write the novel, The Revenge of the Hairy Man. And I only published that like 3 or 4 weeks ago. It's a horror novel, but that's a novel. In my last book, Extreme Expeditions 3, which is non-fiction, I talk about my actual experiences in Port Chatham itself, but my novel has just been released, as I say.
Did you have any experiences with the hairy man in that area?
Yeah, and this is what's interesting. I mean, the whole place, sometimes you can have a sort of priming. It's called cognitive priming. It's when people go into a haunted house and they see ghosts because they're already primed to see ghosts. Do you know what I mean? So you have to be as objective as you can. But the place did have, for want of a better word, a very creepy vibe about it. It really did. It makes you feel uncomfortable. So I can understand why the native peoples there are very suspicious of it. Because they own the land, and we have to get permission off them to go. There was one instance when I was using the night vision equipment, and I saw something rush down the mountain towards it. It was so bad, I told Stephen and Josiah, who was with me at the time, I said, we need to get ready. We need to get ready because this thing's shooting down the mountain fast. And it looked bipedal. It was a long way away, and I recorded it on the floor. Now, it's no Patterson Gimlin, but on the TV show for the Travel Channel, Dr. Robert Alley, who's obviously an expert in his field, scientific expert, basically said, well, you know, it's not determinative, and I'd agree with him, but it certainly looks like there's a large creature demonstrating bipedal, so on 2 feet, locomotion, coming down that hillside. And it suddenly stopped, Johnny, as well. At one point, it just suddenly stopped. It was very weird, and I had my hackles up when that happened. Yeah.
Have you ever been in a situation to where you were really afraid? Were you ever afraid in this area or some other area?
Well, I think in this area, what I had us do when we were on land was we had rotations. So it was only, there was three of us in the first time we went, and there was always two of us awake.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know, in case somebody fell asleep, it's kind of like a military drill. And that was for 3 days, and that was very grueling. The second time I went, when I went with Discovery, we were on a boat, so it was a bit easier. When you're on land, you're obviously... I think that was creepy. I mean, in different parts of the world, yeah. You know, in the Congo, for example, I was shot at. In Sumatra, I've been face-to-face with a tiger. So, yeah, I could mention lots of different situations from my expeditions. It sort of depends what you mean and where.
What do you do? I mean, I've been in areas where I know there's Sasquatch running around me, and I was just trying to keep myself together because I was so afraid. Do you ever get so afraid?
I think what I do is I have those feelings in retrospect, but not at the time. I can keep quite composed at the time. I'm blessed that, you know, when I'm in that very dangerous situation, because I've been in a lot, I've been able to keep composed. But do I have flashbacks, and do I relive some of the more harrowing experiences? Yes, I do. Yeah, so some of them have effect. I mean, I have some PTSD from some of the things that's happened to me in the past, definitely. But I'm quite fortunate in the time, Johnny, I can stay focused. I mean, I think the only other thing about the Port Chatham story was just how intensely weird the town feels. That there's that vibe about it which made me feel uncomfortable. It's almost like an oppressive vibe, for want of a better word. I can't give you anything more tangible than that. Mm-hmm. But I did not feel comfortable when I was there, and I've been there. I've been on two investigations there. That's what I'd say. Other than the fact that it's an intensely beautiful place, but it's a dark beauty.
Have you ever spotted any cryptos out there? Sasquatch, dogmen, any visual sightings while you've been out there?
Not of those particular ones.
Mm-hmm.
I did, many years ago, I was in a place called Norway, Seljord in Norway. It's a lake. And I was investigating their equivalent of the Loch Ness Monster. So it's called the Seljord Serpent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's stories about that go back to the 17th century. Hundreds of years of legends. And I went to do investigation there. I was always interested in how the fjords there might interlink to the sea. And what I did was, with my team, not just me, what I did was I got limnologist reports, and they're the fish experts, and they showed where the concentrations of fish were. I cross-referenced those over the most recent sightings or alleged sightings of the creature. And then, so I was using a lot of detective field work, because a lot of this, you know, I call myself an explorer, but the stuff I do is, a lot of it's not all like exciting every time. Most of it's a lot of back-breaking legwork where nothing much happens. So I'm just giving you the methodology here. And then we use hydrophones in the water rather than sonar. And hydrophones are interesting because they can tell you the noise emissions of the creatures. So they can show whether they're having conversations, for want of a better word. And so I adopted this methodology and I divided my teams up in small boats, really, and not much happened for days and days on end. And then I saw the cellular serpent, much to my shock. I saw it. It was black, and it modulated through the water. It had this undulating up and down motion like a serpent. And what was particularly interesting was that it had barbs on its back, which were exactly like, I was later to learn, I looked them up, a 17th century woodcut. They were the same, which I thought was fascinating. Now, why can I make this assertion with some degree of veracity, with some degree of truth? Well, because the hydrophone emissions, which we recorded at the same time, were then analysed by the Marine Research Institute in Bergen. And the head of their team, Dr. Soldal, said, well, I am astonished to say that this is an unknown species. So their top experts in the world analysed those at the same time I saw the creature and said it came from them. So I can be quite confident in my assertion that I did see what I said I saw. Misidentification, I understand, is rampant in this field. But there I've got some scientific veracity to my assertion, so I feel comfortable saying it.
I saw you on Expedition Unknown recently, a couple times. It's like a repeat. I'll watch it over and over again because I say, hey, that's my buddy Adam Davis. What was that experience like?
Well, I was asked to do Expedition Unknown. They wanted to go to Nepal. And they were asking me, and I'd already been to Nepal with the History Channel to look for the Yeti, but in a different part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to try. I was a bit concerned when I went the first time because I didn't find a lot of new reports of the Yeti. And I was worried about that. I mean, you've got to remember that 70% of this country is untraversed by people. You know, on my first time, that I went to Nepal, I had a clouded leopard come into my camp and roar.
Wow.
You know, because it was curious about people.
Yeah.
And it was in a very remote part of Nepal, and it was where we had to be extracted by a helicopter, and I nearly died on the mountain. That's a whole different story. But the time when I went with Expedition Unknown, I went to the area where there's more concentrations of population, so they're more likely to be a human Yeti encounter. It's around the area where a lot of people go climbing Everest. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, on one occasion, I did actually find what could well have been a Yeti print. I said to Josh Gates, I said, you know, I don't want this entourage of people for this scene. I don't want everybody, you know, the film crew and all the Nepali government officials and everybody else with us. I want me, you, and Tule, who's a really good tracker who I respected. And, I found a print on one occasion, or certainly what looked like a very possible print. A bit of degradation there, and it was on the riverbank where I found it. I mean, what I found was interesting was that was in a place where years and years ago, Tule had found a print in about a mile away from there on for that show Destination Truth, I think it was, which Josh did before that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it seems to be, and the stories about from the locals. Or that they go down to forage for frogs, the amphibians in the water there, which there are many. and that's a good time to go because there are lots of them at that particular time. So, like us in our ancestry, they're omnivorous, opportunistic feeders. That's what they're doing.
How did you get into this? Have you always been into cryptozoology and the unknown?
I was into exploring, and I was also interested in animals. I like to go to unknown places and also interested in animals. So there's a natural link. I mean, obviously, you need. It was all about adventure, and I was self-financed, you know. And I was doing it because I was interested in the answers to questions about these. I was always intellectually curious. And then I did survival courses in association with things like the British Army. That's another long story. And I gradually did them. And I wasn't interested in the media side of things. I mean, you know that very well, Johnny, from our conversations over the years. That sort of happened by accident. I mean, I enjoy it. I love making TV programs. If I could make a series, I'd be in my absolute element because I'd be doing what I love. But so far, I've only done some documentaries. But, yeah, I think it became... I first got in newspapers in England and in across the world because I was successful. Because, you know, I did find evidence, say, of the cellular SERP. And if it was a Loch Ness Monster, it would have been world news. Everybody would know who I was. Just a less glamorous cryptid. And then I found... I and my team found prints of something called the Orang Pendek in Sumatra. And that's a bipedal primate, a bit like the Yeti or a bit like the Bigfoot, only much, much smaller, only about 5 feet tall, roughly. And those prints were analysed by one of the world's leading primatologists. And he said, well, you know, the features on this creature are unique. It's an unknown species. And that made headlines in different newspapers around the world, including America. And then National Geographic contacted me and said, we'd like to do something with you. And I said, okay. So we did something with them. And then I did something with them in Mongolia because they liked what I did. And then I did a few History Channel shows. So I do these things every now and again when they come up. And I like it because it gives me an opportunity to do what I enjoy. And also, these sort of things cost a lot of money. And if they're doing it, they pay for it rather than me.
Right. Right. Well, when are we going to get an Adam Davis show? I'd rather watch you than Josh.
Well, I'd love to do it, man. I'd love to do it. And the thing is, I've had some success. I'd like to hope that I'm good at what I do. I mean, you know, most of the time you don't find things, but I have had some found success, and I am after independent evidence that can be scientifically corroborated. So I have a good methodology in the field. I did good research. But, you know, just look at opportunity, Johnny. Mm-hmm. You know, wish it for me. That's all I can say, man.
You got a guy like Josh. I mean, he's probably a nice guy, whatever. But they're coming to you, you know, to help them.
Yeah, in some instances. I mean, there are plenty of places I would still like to go, and places where I think I can stand a good chance of gathering some decent evidence. But, you know, TV or no, I'll carry on doing it regardless. With as, you know, when I possibly can, with as much money as I can gather, because it's what I love. I've been doing it for so many years now, and I love it. And, you know, I do it. I want people to enjoy my work, but I do it because I want answers to questions. It's never been about seeking acclaim from others or money. Never been interested in any of those things. It's always about, you know, adventures. And that's why I wrote my Extreme Expeditions books, because I thought, well, I should really, some of the things I've done are unique. I should really detail these things down so that after I'm gone, at least people can enjoy them, hopefully, and have a record of them. I didn't want them to be lost. You know, with my first degree being in history, I thought, well, that's important. You'd be a hypocrite if you didn't write these things down. So I'm trying to detail them as I go and doing that as I carry on, you know. I think I'm on a positive note, I'm very blessed to still be alive because some of the risks I've taken have driven my poor mother almost insane.
Oh,
but here
yeah.
I am, sat here talking to you, so it's all good.
Okay, how about the amateur explorer that's just now, you know, starting to want to go out? Do you have any advice for that newbie?
Yeah, I mean, the best thing to do is to start off being thorough. So what do I mean when I say start off being thorough? Well, the first thing you need to do, really, is to know your local woods and your local flora and fauna, know your local animals. Get really into environmental awareness about habitats of species, the way different creatures might behave. Really get to know that. and then gradually branch out, you know. So, for example, what you don't want to do if you're interested in I don't know, bipedal creatures is to go straight out to Nepal. It's a bit of a leap. You know, you get to know what's happening. If you're in Washington State, it's a fascinating... I love Washington State. It's a fascinating and beautiful place. You're blessed to live there. Mm-hmm. It's lovely, you know. I know I'm calling Aberdeen now, and I went through that before. It's wonderful, that area. So, you know, you've got those woods. Get to know the creatures there, understand that, and then gradually branch out. And then, you know, learn what the research methodologies of others and see what you can take from it and then adapt and bring that to your own particular needs. But, you know, you also have to ask yourself the question, what do you want? Do you want an experience just for the sake of it, because that's what makes you happy? Do you want to answer intellectual questions for yourself? Do you want to gather evidence which can be analysed by scientists? What do you want? Yeah, and a lot of people don't even start with that question.
Right, right. Do they want to be famous and be the person?
Yeah, well, if you want to be famous, you're going to be disappointed. I mean, you know, there's always some people who get famous, if you like, but. There's not really a lot of money in it,
mm-hmm.
So you're going to be disappointed if you're looking for money. And I would suggest fame, if you had something like that, might be very fleeting. So you've got to want to do it for other reasons. And you'd be much happier if you do, because, you know, I've got to say to you that realistically, unless you create things in your own mind, you're highly likely to be disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing this for many, many years, many, many years. All over the world, and you know, I've only had a few examples of something which has been really unusual or incredible, and then brief moments of those. Most of the time it's going to be wandering about in the mud, dirty, hungry, and sometimes it's dangerous. It's not like Indiana Jones. It's actually a lot more dangerous than that a lot of the time, and actually a lot more expensive and tedious. So you've got to have a real desire to do these things, I think.
Yeah, I'll talk to some people here that are, you know, Bigfoot, Sasquatch enthusiasts, and they'll say, yeah, we're going to go to Idaho, or they're just going to go far away because we're going to go look for Sasquatch. And I'm like, why are you going anywhere? We have them right here. We're like one of the ground zeros of the world, and you don't need to go anywhere. Go 10 miles in the woods here, you know?
Yeah. No, well, you're right. I mean, the area where you are, and we'll talk about that another time, but there's a lot of activity there, and they have been documented for many centuries. You know, if you said to me, well, where's one of the best places in the United States to look for evidence of Bigfoot, Sasquatch, whatever you want to call it, I'd say, well, right in your locale, Johnny. I mean, there is evidence in Idaho, but why would you go to, unless you want the trip and you just want to see the difference.
Right.
Then,
right.
You know, going out in your local woods, I mean, it also cuts down time and logistics from a practical point of view. You're not traveling for hours, you're traveling for an hour. You've got more time in the woods.
More with my friend cryptozoologist Adam Davis coming up on Strange Harbor.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
I know it's a bipedal primate. I know it walks like us. But what is it? Is it a relic hominid? Is it a type of orangutan, for example, that's evolved to walk like a man? I think it'd be one of the most significant discoveries since the moon landing.
This is Adam Davies, a cryptozoologist on a mission to prove that we don't know everything that's out there.
And I travel all over the world looking for unknown species. So from the Congo jungle looking for potential dinosaurs, to mountains looking for the Yeti in Nepal, to here in California looking for the Hodgie monster. And I try and find credible scientific evidence that these creatures exist. What's so fascinating about the Aram Pendek is the mystery of exactly what it is. People have been talking about the existence of the Orang Pendek right back as far as Marco Polo. The Orang Pendek is often described as being about 5 foot to 5.5 feet tall. It's a small bipedal primate. It's described as having a large torso with the physiology of a chimpanzee. It ranges in color from dark hair on its back to a lighter honey-colored. It's an omnivorous, opportunistic feeder. So what I mean by that is that it snacks as it moves through the forest. But what really strikes people are two particular things. First of all, the human-like face, and most particularly, the fact that it walks like a man.
Adam knows this thanks to this massive collection of footprint castings.
What's unique about this? Well, it's very different to, say, a human foot or an orang foot. Humans and orangutans, for example, have very long toes in contrast to the short toes of this creature. The big toe is divergent, that's away from the main body of the foot. In fact, this particular cast has actual leaf prints on it.
It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. Our guest today, who's been featured in many documentaries, National Geographic, features like that one on PBS, Adam Davis, cryptozoologist, explorer. And just a pretty nice guy. How many books do you have out right now?
I have three non-fiction books.
Mm-hmm.
They're the Extreme Expedition series. I mean, I have an author page on Amazon if anyone's interested in looking at that. So the Extreme Expedition is 1, 2, and 3. And really, they read like diaries, accounts of my adventures. And they start off with my early years, and they go through things that I did in the Congo looking for evidence of an alleged dinosaur, the Makele Mamembe. Sumatra. My books go on through my adventures, my investigations, the evidence I found I didn't find over those three books. That's the Extreme Expedition series, and 1, 2, and 3. The last one was Bigfoot versus the Yeti. And then my first novel is The Revenge of the Poor Chatham Hairy Man, Revenge of the Hairy Man, and that's obviously just been released a few weeks ago. So there's three non-fiction books about my expeditions and one fiction novel about Poor Chatham.
We both have been at the Southern Oregon Habituation Area. Now, my first experience there was over 5 days, and I had some kind of weird things happen. You've been down there, too. Now, did you ever have any Sasquatch experiences or alleged, like, hey, I think that's a Bigfoot? You know, we won't talk about the other stuff unless you want to talk about it. But did you have any kind of Sasquatchy experiences down there?
Well, the difficulty is, it's difficult to answer your question because my experiences there were so clouded by what happened to me subsequently that I couldn't really tell. Tell you with any veracity, because after I saw those horrible creatures, that's really difficult to say. I mean, there could have been some evidence. I mean, John found something that may well have been a print, but it was difficult to say. And then we were so consumed for nights by what happened with those awful things that it's difficult really to say. I mean, we did hear things moving in the forest. We did hear what may have been grunts, but it's almost negated by, because those things were around and because of what they were capable of, I'm not sure I can trust that evidence, if that makes sense, Johnny.
So it's, you were distracted, let's say.
Well, I mean, later on, I was all consumed by what happened. I mean, there was some potential things which interested me in the first instance, which may have pointed to Sasquatch, that's true. But because of those things and what their plans may have been, I'm not sure whether it really was or whether it was smoke and mirrors from them. You know, I mean, it's difficult to say.
And what you're referring to has been talked about, documented. You've talked about this online, so there's no need to really discuss it here, right?
That would be something that would require a lengthy conversation. I don't think we can fit it in a few minutes.
Right. And I don't want you to feel uncomfortable or like, oh, no, not this again, or I've already talked about this. You know, I just want you to be happy, you know?
Yeah, no, that's cool. Well, you know, if you want me, if we do do a presentation at Sasquatch Summit, I'll talk about it there probably in more length, if that's what you'd like me to do.
No, I just want you to do whatever you want to do, my friend. Now, you were here for the Sasquatch Summit, I think it was, what, two years ago? Was it 2 years?
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to do any exploring while you were here?
Yeah, I did some. I mean, I did really enjoy the Sasquatch Summit. I'm not just saying that because you organize it. It's because it's true. I don't have to say that.
Thank you.
It did. The people were lovely, and I enjoyed the venue. And I did. I got an opportunity to go. Well, I'd already been to the Olympic Forest, and I enjoyed that very much. But I got an opportunity to go out into the Ho and have a look around there, and that was wondrous. I love it. I love your area. And we're going down these small lanes, and it's just forest after forest after beautiful forest. And I was like, oh, I could be out here forever. And I know there are areas that you and I have talked about before which are of special interest in terms of Bigfoot Sasquatch investigations, which I'd certainly like to go and do with you. But, yeah, no, I did explore it, and it was wondrous. I mean, I think you are blessed to live in a very lovely area, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And hey, how was your Olympic Project trip? I know it's been a while, but...
Yeah, it was a good few years ago. It was great. I mean, it was... Derek Randall was running it, and I think he still is running it. And it was a number of years ago now. I met Shane there and that. And I did some calls at the time and got calls back, which certainly sounded like a possible Bigfoot at the time. We were all very interested in that. I mean, there seems to be... this is conjecture on my part, but it does seem to be, I mean, based on all the research and ideas, there's a lot of potential for evidence in your part of the world. Probably, you know, I've traveled quite a lot across the United States now, and I can't think of a place right now where there's a greater concentration of activity. There's one small pocket of Florida, which I'm particularly interested in. But in terms of the concentration of activity, I'd say, you know, it's right up there in terms of activity. I mean, it's a great place to go, you know, and hopefully we'll get an opportunity to go out together sometime and do that. It'd be great.
Oh, yeah, totally. Now, I'm asking you this because I want the skeptic or the unconvinced or just the... enthusiast that always asks the question, but coming from someone of your stature, your credibility, why do you think we don't have better video, better photos, better evidence of Sasquatch?
Well, I think it's a reasonable question, and it's one that I've pondered myself. And I'm not trying to explain it away, I'm just trying to give you examples. So, you know, when I often see wildlife, it's very... I mean, it takes a few seconds to react sometimes, and in those few seconds, normally it's gone. You know that yourself, even if you try to take a photograph of a bird. It, you know, a lot of the big research projects that have focused on creatures, so they have more resources than the average person does who goes out to look for Bigfoot over a week or even 2 weeks. And, you know, I'll give you an example. So we talked about the leopard earlier on, that clouded leopard. Well, you know, when they were filming the Planet Earth series, it took nearly a year for them to film a sequence. So the cameraman was there for nearly a year. He'd almost given up before he captured them, and that was his full-time job for a year. You know, when I was in Mongolia, for example, and one of the guys there was saying to him, you know, he said, my reservation, I'm responsible for the leopard. And I said, well, how many times have you seen it? He said, well, once or twice, maybe twice. And I said, well, how long have you been here? And he said, 30 years.
Wow.
And I also, and I'm going to summarize what I mean in a minute, because I'm going to distill some examples and then I'll summarize. So one of my good friends, Jeremy Holden, is a professional cameraman. He's photographed more unknown species than any other person in the world. He photographs tigers regularly, for example, and he's a great field researcher. And he saw the Orang Pendek in Sumatra, and he saw it for the first time, and he froze. And this is him talking. He froze because it looked so like a person, but not a person. It freaked him out. It took him a few seconds to recover, and one of my friends, Dave, you know, had exactly the same experience, and in those few seconds, it was gone. So, an explanation in summary. Number one, They're extremely rare and very elusive and highly intelligent. Number two, you know, most of the times when you see these things, unless you're in a situation where you're very lucky, that you might catch a glimpse of them for a few seconds, and in that few seconds they're gone. And thirdly, when people do see them, often they're freaked out and disturbed, and that's the reaction time they need to get those photographs, to get that evidence. And I've been with people who are very sensible and cogent, and even professionals who that's happened to. Now, those are my best explanations. I mean, people are always going to say, well, you know, that doesn't satisfy me. And I understand that, but I'm not here to evangelize to people. I'm here to share my work with them, and I hope they enjoy it. But, you know, hopefully a really good photograph will happen. You know, I'm with you on the point that it can't be blurry photographs or it can't be a glimpse, unless it's at least as good as the Patterson and Gimlin film, and if not better, it doesn't take the story any further. So, you know, I'm not into blurry photographs. I understand why people are cynical about it, but I am with them in the sense that we need really good evidence, otherwise it's not worth it. I don't want to see, you know, if someone sends me a photograph and it, you know, they're putting red circles on things in bushes, then I'm really not interested.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
You must do, man. I know you do.
That is funny.
Of course, Johnny. That's what we say.
Oh, boy. No, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I dare you not to edit that. I dare you.
Okay. I will leave it in, man, because you dared me. You know? I got to. Oh, so do you think the Patterson-Gimlin footage is legitimate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, on a personal level, you know, I should declare an interest. It's important I declare bias. And I like Bob Gimlin a lot. You know, I hang out with him from time to time. I respect him a lot. He wrote a foreword for my third book. So on a personal level, I like him, and that creates a bias in itself. I'm conscious of that. You know, as I say to you, I'm always about gathering independent, corroborative scientific evidence. But if there is any bias, I should declare it. So there's my bias. Now, in terms of why I think it's probably genuine, it's because of the gates, because of the walk, and without going into it for too much detail, because it's over and over again, that's a very big creature walking in a very purposeful manner, with a specific stride and gait, which would be very difficult for a person to emulate, to copy over those conditions without in a suit, without becoming an incredible difficulty, and it's performed effortlessly and at speed. So in synopsis, I think it would be difficult to reproduce. And also, you know, the other thing is it a suit? Well, Roger Patterson was no special effects maestro. You know, he was a normal guy, and I mean that in a not uncomplimentary way. We're all normal guys, but you know, the guys who made the Planet of the Apes, the original Planet of the Apes, it's my understanding that they said, you know, they wouldn't have been able to do those sort of special effects with the budgets that they had, and they won an Oscar for their ape suits, and they declared that that was more complex than theirs. So if Roger Patterson had created a suit like that, and the person in it had been able to perform a walk like that so effortlessly to camera, while he struggled with the camera and fell off the horse, and it was all planned and choreographed that way, that would be an incredible achievement in itself. It would be quite remarkable how he had managed that. So I think it's genuine, yeah.
One of the many topics that we cover on Strange Harbor, ghosts. Have you ever had any experiences that led you to believe that it was like a spirit or ghostly kind of thing?
In terms of Bigfoot, no. I think it's a physical creature. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may well have unusual qualities to it, which we don't fully understand. I'm quite prepared to entertain the fact of that, but I'm not going to entertain the fact that it's just a ghost. No, mm-hmm. I think it's got physical qualities to it. Definitely. I mean, there are many accounts of people seeing it consuming food or hunting, for example. I think it eats. I think it lives. I think it breathes. I think it's very rare. It may well be incredibly resourceful and have abilities which we do not understand. but I don't think it's a spirit as such. It's not to say that I dismiss the notion of spirits. I mean, anybody who has any vestige of religion can't do that. And, you know, I would like to declare that I'm a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I believe in the notion of spirits and the afterlife. I just don't see any tangential link between them and Bigfoot.
So you do believe that ghosts exist?
Well, I believe that spirits exist in some form or another, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How about UFOs?
Well, I think given the nature of the universe, there are more planets out there than there are grains of sand on every beach in the world. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
If all the beaches in the world were to put the grains of sand on, there are more planets out there. We now know that there are literally trillions of planets in what's known as the Goldilocks zone,
mm-hmm.
which is the habitable zone, which is neither too hot nor too cold in association or next to a sun. So the idea that there is no life out there in the universe is incredibly it's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just absurd thinking to suggest that there wouldn't be life. Now the question is, and it goes to the Drake equation, you know, where is that intelligent life? And most people would say now, well, that intelligent life, is it too far away to visit it, or has it already visited us, or are we in some sort of quarantine? That's really the intellectual question. For me, we should be well beyond the notion of whether life exists in the universe. That's just intensely primitive thinking.
Dang. How do you really feel?
That's how I really feel.
Okay. I have a tendency to let my own biases, my own subjective opinions and assumptions kind of cloud the evidence. How do you separate that? How could you teach me not to let my own mind interfere with what's really happening?
It's because it's not really what you think is important, yeah? So it really, you have to suspend your ego.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about you. It's really about the evidence. So what I think and what you think is irrelevant,
mm-hmm.
yeah? You know, what I think does not hold up to independent scrutiny. What I think isn't going to lead to a classification of the species. What I think has no value in that sense. So that's the starting point. And a lot of people think that what they think is important, like they're politicians. Well, it's not. You need to go approach it from a different angle. So it's about the quality of the evidence that you produce. And can I have that analysed? And can that analysation be replicated by others so that we can get some scientific review process in? I mean, that's what I'm interested in. You know, I talked about what you should be interested in, what your focus is, and it's up to you. That's what I'm interested in. So I might think I have a Bigfoot hair, but it's irrelevant what I think. So then it has to be analyzed. Then we have to see if we can get the DNA from it. Then the person who extracted that DNA has to be prepared to share his evidence or her evidence for peer review with at least two or three other people before you can draw a conclusion. So I like to say that I am a field researcher who gathers evidence for credible scientists to analyze. And that's what I am. And I'm no more or no less.
What gear do you take out when Adam Davis is going out into the woods or in the mountains to explore and find something? What kind of things do you take for your scientific approach?
Well, it depends on the terrain. It depends where I'm going to. You know, it's harder if I'm going somewhere like the mountains or the jungle, like Nepal or the Congo, because you're there for a long time. But you really, you know, on a basic level, you'll take your, obviously you take your personal equipment, your survival equipment, your med pack, and then evidence to handle samples, so for example DNA testing kit samples that you can take there, a little kit for those so you don't contaminate it, gloves and things like that, rubber gloves so you can bag and tag that stuff, night vision equipment, trail cameras, whatever I feel like doing, you know. But as I say to you, most of the time I'm finding nothing. Nothing on many, many occasions. And that's why I'm inherently suspicious of people who say, oh, you know, like every time they go out or every couple of times they go out, they see a Bigfoot. And I just think that's just fantasy, you know. They see a Bigfoot around that red bush that they've circled. Yeah. And you know what? You know what with those red bushes? There's always a baby somewhere. There's always a baby in there. There's a young one, you know.
Right. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to start laughing again.
Really?
Well, hey, I know you don't do many of these interviews, and I know you're taking the time to talk with me because we're buddies, and I love you for it, and I don't want to take up any more of your time than I already have. You're on your lunch break, and I really feel bad because Cherie, you know, Cherie is the scientist. She's the MUFON investigator. I always rely on her questions, and then I just chime in, you know, and so she doesn't know a lot about this stuff, so she asks the typical questions, and I didn't have her to do that, so I kind of just limped my way through it. But thank you so much for talking with me today.
No, it's my pleasure, Johnny. I've enjoyed it. It's lovely to speak to you, and hopefully, you know, you and I can chat soon, and, you know, if maybe one day we'll have an opportunity to talk to Sherry soon.
Oh, yeah. And I can find your books on Amazon?
Yeah, you can find them on Amazon. I have an author page on Amazon, the Extreme Expedition series, and the last one, The Revenge of the Hairy Man, the novel. It's best to go to, if you want to find them, if you just Google Extreme Expedition 3, Bigfoot versus Yeti, that'll take you to that book. And then from there, you can go on my author page and see the other books. And if you want to buy one, please feel free.
What's the website?
John Carson's been running the website, but I haven't really promoted it recently. If you go to adamdavisexplorer.com, you can find me there.
Okay, and I hope to have you here this November for the Sasquatch Summit.
Well, I hope so, too. I'd love to see you again. I'd love to go, and maybe we can get an opportunity to go out as well. So hopefully that will all come together.
Okay, well, you have a great weekend. Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Johnny. I appreciate you. You take care, man. I'll speak to you very soon.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. If you would like to hear back episodes, if you want to buy Strange Harbor merch, if you want to get a hold of us, yell at us for being tinfoil hat-wearing whack jobs, log on to strangeharbor.net.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.